Okay, can you just start by saying your name and what your current position is?
Yes, my name is Klaas Kicheller, and I'm an assistant professor of the history of medicine at University College Dublin.
And what was your previous connection with the Oxford Vaccine Group?
Before going to Dublin, I started my post on January 1st, 2020. I was a member of the Oxford Martin School, where I was a member of the programme on collective responsibility for infectious disease.
Okay. So just to sort of kind of warm you up, can you tell me how you first got interested in history or in general or history of medicine in particular, and what have been the main staging posts on your career up to the point where you came to Oxford?
It's been quite a long winding history, I have to say. So I started off studying ancient history and medieval history. And I did that in Munich in Germany and got increasingly interested in the role of the environment in shaping past societies. And while I was studying in Munich, they founded a new institute called the Rachel Carson Institute for the Study of the Environment. And I was fortunate enough to get a paid research assistant post there and kind of got sucked increasingly into the contemporary period, working for another historian called Frank Ükötter. That kind of grounded my interest in the environment more broadly. And while researching the environment, I had to start picking a thesis topic for myself. And antibiotics seemed to be a great way of combining this interest in how human culture shaped the environment, but also in turn shaped by the environment. So that got me into antibiotics. I was fortunate enough to be able to study at the University of Chicago, do a master's there. And after coming back from Chicago, wanted to continue within the English speaking area of research. So my wife and I were again fortunate enough to get a post in Oxford. And because of Wellcome funding, I transitioned from being an environmental historian to becoming a historian of medicine with a very strong focus on the environment. And did my dissertation research on the history of antimicrobials and their regulation with a strong focus on food regulation, food production.
So a lot of your work, more and more it seems recently, is very policy orientated, and it's almost social policy research rather than history. So how do you see a long perspective as being important in examining these issues?
I think a long perspective is absolutely crucial for all issues within the field of policy. And to be honest, the boundaries between policy and history often blur. I mean, every historian lives in the present, and we are shaped by the things that surround us, by the events we witnessed in terms of how we then witness and perceive long-term path dependencies in the past. So thinking about the coronavirus pandemic, I think that all history of medicine will be written differently after COVID. I don't think there's a way to transplant your brain to prior moments of time. So I think my work is still very much anchored in myself working as a historian and looking through long-term trends, but I'm quite explicit about where I stand within the policy arena and also try to bring this long-term view into policy. And that's, I think, perhaps a result of having this postdoc at the Oxford Martin School, where it was all about answering grand challenges. So climate change, antimicrobial resistance, vaccine hesitancy. And in each of these areas, history and the long-term trends, the structural determinants shaping specific usage patterns, the cultural fears, the inequalities that are anchored, they all shape the field of possible actions in the present. And I think historians have historically been a bit too reluctant to engage with the present. The present is very messy, right? You know, it hasn't been distilled down to a set of deposited sources yet. But at the same time, the present is continuously drawing on history and meaning making to shape political action going forward. So in many ways, a historian can serve as a kind of guide into the long term. Doesn't mean I have a particularly better view on the future than anybody else in the view in the room, but I think it's sometimes there is an advantage of seeing the structural path dependencies play out in a certain decision setting and highlighting alternatives.
That's a very good explanation. And what about the methods that you use? Because I mean, clearly, if you're looking at medieval history, you're dependent on a rather thin collection of paper sources, but working very strongly in the present, you've got more available to you. What methods do you mainly rely on?
What I really enjoyed when I was doing medieval history was the incredible transformation the field was going through, in parallel to archaeology too, with the advent of genomics, with the advent of better scientific ways of understanding wider environments, and also the application of ethnographic methods to the past to understand, for example, ritual modes of communication and sources. So I think actually the scarcity of sources made medieval historians very creative, but also very sophisticated in engaging with the knowledge of other disciplines in terms of just anchoring how people were interacting with the non-human factors around them. And moving to the present, that's obviously very useful to employ too. In the present, however, you have a different challenge, which is often too many sources, right? We're surrounded by an incredible wealth of information that's also been deposited in the archives since the 19th, 20th century, really. And so for me, the challenge was always about combining a way of navigating through this wealth of sources in the present while not losing this medieval focus on context and the environment. So the methods I employ are always a mix. I'm very interested in meaning making by different groups of people. So I focused a lot on my research using sociological methods developed by a German sociologist called Ulrich Beck, to understand how people conceive of risk and how common fears shape societal action, create groups within society, and lead to distinct forms of distribution. And you can do that with lots of digital humanities methods. So you can do mass analysis of source databases. You can also do very detailed readings of individual sources or policy documents. But I'm also at the same time very interested in how these risks are shaped by very real environmental shifts that I can also pin down with environmental evidence or microbial evidence. And I'm not a microbiologist myself, but I work a lot with microbiologists, with environmental scientists, and thinking and talking very openly with them about some of the structural constraints we see. We're trying to establish frameworks that integrate these two ways of forces when it comes to analyzing our past, but also the non-human past.
I think I was also getting at the fact that there are witnesses still around who you can.
Oh yes, yes, yeah. That's absolutely true, and I mean, in many ways, I'm becoming a witness myself, right, by participating in this oral history interview. Yes. So that's the other part of the research. So it's, you know, I still see myself as a classic historian in many ways, but I obviously also draw on lots of the gray knowledge specifically that many of the witnesses have. To give you an example, for one of the books that I've written on the history of animal welfare politics in the UK, I drew a lot on interviews with senior scientists who were also involved in policy circles, but also some of the activists who had encountered the prime activist in my book, Ruth Harrison. And it wasn't really so much about verifying individual facts or, you know, trying to get a complete record of history, but it was more to see how these people understood their own role and how they understood the internal dynamics of the field developing. So that's also a very useful source of information for historians that we often don't get in the quite formalistic sources, specifically in the policy area that are deposited in the archives.
Well, let's arrive at COVID now. Can you remember where you were when you first heard that there was something going on? There was a respiratory outbreak in China, and how soon it was before you realized that it was something that was going to be affecting the world?
I think it was in the first couple of days of January when these tweets started coming around. Twitter is a great source of information for myself. When you follow the right people, you do get pinged about lots of very interesting things that are going on. And so I think I was in North Germany with my family for Christmas, and I saw a tweet saying, this sounds ominous, mysterious respiratory outbreak in China. And I continued following this. Soon afterwards, I went to North America for a conference. And at that point, it was already very clear that there was something going on. The first people were wearing masks. And then I flew out to a typhoid conference in Dhaka in Bangladesh with all of the public health establishment of the UK, Germany,
which
France.
When was and that? Can you remember which month?
This was... I would have to look up the date. I think this was early February, I think,
early February.
Going forward. And what was really remarkable at this conference was that lots of these very high profile people who were involved in the vaccine response, in the lockdowns, et cetera, going out, they started disappearing from one breakfast to the next. So something was clearly happening, and there was a clear mood of emerging concern of people there. You also saw participants starting to mask up. I think, you know, they were very aware of what was happening. Handshells started appearing. This was before that became very, very common in the public at home. So when I came back to Oxford, where I was still living at that point, I told my family, you know, we should probably, that something's coming, we should probably stock up on at least some kind of basic things for the larder in case we get it and can't go out. And I went then to Liverpool for another talk on infectious diseases. And on the way back, I sat behind somebody who was coughing a lot, was clearly unwell. And the next day I came down, well, not the next day, but 2 days later, I came down with quite a high fever. My daughter also came down with quite a high fever. I don't know what it was. It could have just been the flu. But from that point on, we first voluntarily locked ourselves away, and then the lockdowns were announced.
Mm, mm, mm. And at what point were you asked to become involved in documenting the work of the vaccine group?
It was a very fluid process. I'd been contacted as part of the Martin School group, but also as part of the Oxford Vaccine Group, where I was a voluntary, an honorary vaccine historian. I think that's my title on the website. I'd been media requests were being fielded to me about journalists who wanted to have a longer term view on the history of vaccine development and the history of infectious disease control. And so it was a gliding.
Oh, we need process. To get, so your association with the vaccine group preceded the... I didn't understand that.
Yes.
Tell me how that came about.
Within the Oxford Martin School program that I was part of as a postdoc, there were multiple groups there. So one was led by Angela McLean, who is now the UK's chief scientific officer. The other one was headed by Andy Pollard, who played a big role in the testing of the coronavirus vaccine. Mm-hmm. And the historians group was headed by Mark Harrison, my PI, and also my doctoral supervisor at what was then the Wellcome Unit for the History of Medicine. And we'd been discussing all of these challenges. We'd had lots of debates on vaccine hesitancy, designed exhibitions on typhoid control. And I think I was just the historian that people knew in this group constellation. And I'd negotiated, as you know, while I was starting my new post of Dublin, to keep some of those old affiliations. I'd been assigned the title of this historian of the vaccine group. And we started, again, filling these media requests. I featured in one of the Netflix documentaries on coronavirus race to the vaccine. It was really just about providing context, longer-term context about how we could think about these vaccine rollouts and vaccine hesitancy in longer time frames. But the more we were providing history for other people, the more we became aware that obviously lots of exciting things were also happening within Oxford during this time. So Samantha Vanderslot, my colleague within the Oxford Vaccine Group, and myself, we started thinking of creating a time capsule of interviews just while this crisis was ongoing, just regular chats to people about where they came from biographically, but also how they perceive different challenges. And we started creating a series of oral history interviews.
Do you remember when that was, when you started?
Yes, I think we started formally doing this in early 2021. Right after the kind of big rollouts were starting. Yeah. But we were having these informal discussions earlier on. And we'd also been contacted by a team of lawyers by this point to also think through some of the ethical and legal challenges of trialing, of human challenge trials, which were a big topic at this time, and also vaccine adverse effects. We'd already been chatting with them earlier about, you know, the lack of a UK framework that had been updated to compensate adequately for adverse effects. And we published a policy brief in October 2020, I believe, on the need for some kind of special scheme to be created for COVID to just deny oxygen for vaccine hesitancy going forward, but also really helping people who had done the right thing but suffered adverse effects while doing the right thing going forward. Now, unfortunately, that wasn't implemented. But as a result of this, also, it led to a lot more press interest and also interest, academic interest in how these schemes could be optimized going forward.
So, yes, I interrupted you. You were just saying you decided to collect oral history interviews. So they were, and this, I'm just coming to understand how all this worked, because I think I had a sense of you almost embedded within the group and watching events as they unfolded. But if you didn't start till 2021, then you were getting a retrospective view from them of what had happened since, January, really, I think, was when the first, when they first made the construct that was going to be the basis for the
Absolutely.
Bank.
I mean, we'd been obviously kept in the loop and we'd attended the virtual lab meetings going forward. But again, we were historians and social scientists, and this was a time of biosecurity confinement. So there was, I think it would have been pretty unethical for us to break some of the lockdown restrictions to go into these sites and, you know, to conduct field work.
Sorry, when I said embedded, I did mean within the room.
But B, also, obviously, neither of us is a trained microbiological researcher. So there was also a little point of us going in there. And C, obviously, lots of these discussions, specifically the discussions about the vaccine race. I mean, we were hearing lots of things, but it was quite a loaded atmosphere also with Brexit happening and, you know, discussions about vaccine allocation happening at that point. So I think it would have been difficult to conduct interviews in that setting. There were also concerns about IT security in Oxford. We had to do all of the work virtually, right? So all of these things were circling around. So I think that's where the formal start of the project really happened in early 2021.
And I think you were quite careful about setting up the ethics and the security, in possibly to a greater extent than I have been on this project. But that, so what hoops did you have to jump through?
Well, we had to go for ethics clearance because while all of the people we were interviewing were quite senior, they were perfectly articulate, they were masters in giving media interviews at this point. We were asking them to reflect quite candidly on their experience. And we were also obviously asking them to reflect about broader timescales. COVID is obviously the big pandemic of our time. Many of them had also been involved in the Ebola response earlier. And there were a lot of tensions, I think, about that rollout still in the historical memory, in the recent historical memory. So everybody had to have the opportunity to speak openly to us, but also then have the opportunity of saying, I don't want this published. I want this banned for so and so many years before it's released, etc. And we were, you know, they were also our colleagues that we were interviewing. So we really wanted to be very diligent that we weren't unintentionally exposing anybody to negative effects down the stream. And we were also very intent on saying that we weren't journalists. We weren't looking for any smoking gun. We were really interested in the context of how these decisions were not just coming down the road in 2020, but it had actually been pre-shaped by 10 to 20 years of structural changes in the UK vaccine industry and vaccine research beforehand.
And how willing were the members of the group? And this, when we, I've used the phrase the Oxford Vaccine Group, but there were two groups here, weren't there? There was the Oxford Vaccine Group and there was the Jenner, and the whole vaccine project involved people from both of those units. So you were talking to people across the board, across those two units. And I think my question was, how enthusiastic were they about the project?
I think throughout all of my time working with researchers in the biomedical sciences, I've always been struck how open they are and how interested they are in social sciences. So it's a very, very open group. They're very self-reflective. And there was a great sense that this was an important, useful project. We obviously started with what we knew, you know, and who we knew. So we started initially actually working with Richard Moxon, initially the founder of the Oxford Vaccine Group, and Andy Pollard, you know, whom we both knew quite well, who was the head and still is the head of the Oxford Vaccine Group. But that then quickly became enmeshed with also looking at people within the Jenner Institute, who were obviously involved in designing the vaccine, making many of the big commercialization decisions or non-commercialization decisions. And but we were also really interested in the people you know, in the people who were absolutely essential in running the trials, in, you know, vaccine nurses, the administrators within these units, who just, you know, overnight had to deal with an international emergency, with the resources of a university academic post, which aren't a lot. So that was a very, it was a very natural, it was a very fluid networking experience. We talked to some people, they said we should talk to other people. And I think everybody we asked ended up saying yes. I mean, sometimes we had to take time to just explain the project, explain, you know, the security levels that we would put in place. But again, I think everybody quickly realized that we were not out there to get anyone. We were just interested in understanding the situation.
And roughly how long did you interview them each for? And I got quite interested in the nuts and bolts of how you did this. And did you tend to, did each interviewee just have one session, or did you go back to them for more than one session?
Oh, for some people, we had 10 sessions.
Oh my goodness.
It was because neither of us were paid to do this. Neither of us had, you know, we didn't have to go through the standard grant writing process of, you know, calculating our hours. This was really pure research for us. We said it'll take as long as it takes, and also as long as people are willing to talk to us. I mean, they're also very busy people. But I think with Andy, I think we have a series of interviews over essentially all of 2021, which was a very interesting year also for perspectives to evolve. With Richard, we did interviews also, I think, for close to 12 months of interviewing. And it was very rich, and we could just come back to things said earlier. It was a very rewarding process. I don't think I'd ever get a grant application through though with this work plan, which was very, you know, it evolved. It wasn't planned completely.
And how many people did you do all together in the end, or is it still going on?
I think we finished now. I would have to go to our list of people to say how many we've actually interviewed at the end. We've got a very rich corpus. Now, again, because we didn't formally apply for funding, we have to code all of these things ourselves. So it's in addition to the standard jobs. So it's taking a bit longer than we thought it would. But we have a very rich collection, I think, of all spheres of within the Jenner Institute and within OVG, but also further afield, people who were involved in MHRR, decision-making at this time of just interviews covering the field. So the idea is to make this available, hopefully by the end of this year, everything will be out, everything will be published within the constraints of the ethics agreements, obviously.
Just as they stand. Or will there be any sort of contextual work around them?
We obviously, so I'm clearly a historian, so I'm very interested in linking this to some of my research on research infrastructures in the UK for biomedicine since the 1990s. I think there's a lot to be unpacked here, a lot to understand with all of the grey knowledge about who was making which decisions, how agencies were interacting, etc. So that is very clearly the goal here once it's released. The release itself will also be a contextual database. So rather than, I think, doing what is often the case in oral history, where it's essentially a data dump. You collect all of this data, it's dumped onto a website, and the website isn't maintained. And I mean, nobody listens to 20 hours of interviews ever again, unless it's a very detailed research project. We want to index it and make it searchable via keyword terms, etc., so that we create value also going forward, so that this is a corpus of interviews rather than just, you know, 20 hours of people talking.
Yes, I'm rather jealous of that, because I think my interviews at the moment are in the form of a set of recordings which are there going up on the university podcast.
I think that's great also with the university podcast, and I think that's a great way of communicating directly to the public. But I think for a historian, I've worked a lot with oral history interviews that other people have also done in the past, and it's always been very productive for me to not only have the transcript, but really to be able to see the kind of interconnections, the neural network of the people who were doing the interviews and why they selected certain people, how certain themes emerged, etc. So we really just want to experiment again, because we don't have a grant that's dictating when we have to publish, when we have to get things done, to really experiment this and do this well, and have something that is meaningful for future researchers. We'll also be analyzing us, I guess, you know, how we did these things.
Yes, yes. And I mean, have you had, you must, although you haven't had time to analyze it properly, what do you think the main themes are that have emerged that you'd like to explore in more detail?
I think the big theme that has emerged was how much 2020 had been pre-framed by what happened 5 years earlier during Ebola. And how much the technological development between 2010 and 2015 predetermined what we then saw as vaccine generations coming out. I mean, there are obviously other very interesting themes running through these interviews, such as how British researchers see their place within the world of vaccine research in general, right? Britain doesn't have a large vaccine manufacturing capability, hadn't really invested a huge amount in vaccine innovation during the 1990s, was starting to do it again. Brexit obviously also runs through this. So this reevaluation of where do we stand, what are our relations with our European colleagues, those things run through there. But I think the biggest interesting thing for me really is how, A, biographically, a very distinct cohort of vaccine researchers emerged in the UK in the 1980s, 1990s, all shaped by education experiences in North America. B, how this translates into the need to redesign UK vaccine policy as a result of the sell-off of big industry and the transition of industry abroad. And then C, how Oxford as a distinct cluster, a very effective cluster of research centers evolves to really dominate part of the UK vaccine response in 2020. Obviously, none of this happened overnight. And so it's really, I think these interviews allow you to reconstruct how Oxford as a vaccine center, as a vaccine hub emerged, but also how the UK's position in the world of biomedical research and innovation changed over the last 40 years.
And continues to change, because I mean,
absolutely.
I know that you've made a policy commentary, published such a commentary on the decision to sell off the Vaccine Manufacturing Innovation Centre, the VMIC, which was presumably sited near Oxford for the very reasons that you described. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yes, I mean, the policy commentary was very much a surprise. We'd studied the VMIC quite closely ahead of these decisions to sell it off being announced, because we thought it was a great model for non-emergency innovation outside of pandemic situations that could be applied to other areas, such as, for example, antimicrobial innovation. And the beautiful thing about the VMIC was that it was designed to both create critical upscale capacity for vaccine production, to allow very small manufacturing capacities at research centers to be upscaled for phase one, phase two, phase three trials before handing them over to industry during emergencies. But it would also act as an incubator for all of this very rich biotech scene that has emerged around the UK's leading universities to use these facilities to you know, create commercial products, monoclonal antibodies, vaccine technology, I mean, you name it, going forward. And we thought that this could also be applied to other areas which suffer from market constraints, such as antimicrobial innovation, where you just have a research infrastructure in place that is publicly supported, but just provides this critical ramp-up capacity beyond the standard commercial valley of death. So we were very surprised when the sell-off was announced and decided to write a commentary challenging the rationale behind it. From what we were given to understand, I should say here that we weren't given to understand this at all by people within the vaccine group, the Oxford Vaccine Group or the Jenner Institute. This was information we had from separate sources. The decision seems to have been made as a result of attempts to save costs following the pandemic rollout in all areas of government, and that this was seen as low-hanging fruit, which could just be rolled out. But we thought it was a mistake, because the VMIC and this focus on preparedness that could also be integrated into capacity building more broadly, was such a cornerstone of what this new scene of research that had emerged in the UK around vaccines since 2000 had really been lobbying for. So selling it off right after it had actually proved its worth during the initial pandemic response made no sense whatsoever to us. It's now been sold off, unfortunately, I think, but it was this piece was really about querying this decision from a long-term perspective where the next pandemic will inevitably hit at some point.
Yeah.
And where it is important to have a critical upscale capacity in place that doesn't necessarily follow commercial determinants. Industry is not always the best at getting the next health threat right, especially when there's not a lot of money involved in investing in the next threat that may be around the corner, whereas academia can do this. And if you create this infrastructure of upscaling, that's a very important national asset to have. So that was really what this piece was about.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, you talked about the variety of people that you interviewed. I think that's something that struck me very much, is that the success of the project depended very much on people with a very wide range of skills. And no one individual could possibly have done, or, you know, even if you cloned one person, they couldn't have done it. You had to have this very wide range of skills. Was that something that struck you as well when you were talking to them?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you talk to historian colleagues of mine, they'll know that I'm not a big fan of the Alexander Fleming myth that's grown up around penicillin. And I think completely misleads, lots of people who don't have an active stake in biomedical innovation to think of these moments of genius and, you know, heroic individual, usually white men in lab coats making big scientific breakthroughs. I mean, no big breakthrough in biomedicine in the 20th or 21st century is the result of heroic individuals. It's always the result of big science. A big science, be it public big science or be it private big science, but big science which has a 10 to 20 year horizon. The vaccine technologies we're using now, they were thought of in the 1990s, in the early 2000s, you know, the first experiments started. And so that was very clear from the beginning. It didn't come as a huge surprise to myself or to Sam, because I think we'd just been working this area for so long. That was a big goal of this interview project, was capturing this infrastructure of development.
Mm-hmm. And did you encounter any kind of anxiety about credit across the team, about, you know, who would and wouldn't be recognized for the work that they've done?
No. I honestly have to say, in 2021, when we were doing these interviews, it was really about, you know, I mean, they'd been working to the bone, that entire team. To get this over the line, they'd obviously had the adverse effects report coming out of North America. They'd had the vaccine distribution concerns going forward. And I think at that point, everybody was really just very focused. To be honest, we also weren't that interested in that question. I think it was something that obviously got repeatedly raised in the press. But considering what we really thought this was a story about, namely a story about investments 20 to 30 years ago starting to manifest in a very specific way, never really was a big interest of ours. I mean, you know, we got lots of anecdotes about personal and institutional rivalries dating back to the 1980s playing out in some contexts, but none of this was at, I think, at the fore of our interviewees' minds when they were mm-hmm. speaking to us about how things were going in 2020-21.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it could popped into my mind because of what you said about the Alexander Fleming complex.
Yes.
Really, if you ask anybody who developed the Oxford vaccine, everybody will say Sarah Gilbert, and she's got a Barbie doll, and you know she has, the focus has been very much on her, and that's purely a media phenomenon, really, that they like to have one person to focus on. So her role has been falsely, I think, exaggerated, possibly at the expense of the other team members.
I think Sarah Gilbert herself may not always have been very comfortable with this eye that was put on her. I think that in general, the team, as we witnessed it, it was the mission focus was really extraordinary on, mm-hmm. on delivering. But it was also very clear that it could only ever be a team focus, right? I mean, they had to go through extraordinary sacrifices in terms of manning the lab, staffing the lab, I should say, and in terms of, just all of the international attention being put onto them during a very intensive, also personal time of their lives. Obviously, they were also all at risk of contracting the infection. Mm. So that never struck me. I think in retrospect, it is something I think that historians have to get better at, but also I think science journalists really have to get better at, is that the need to tell a good story shouldn't trump the necessity to tell an accurate story or to have an accurate reflection of what's going on there. Because I think as a result of that, it allows the public also to too quickly lose sight of things that need to be put in place or maintained now in preparation for the next event. I mean, we see the reports about H5N1, right? Going around at the moment. We need not only surveillance, we need not only vaccine manufacturing capability, we need the networks to be in place, and we need to have the personal continuities of expertise guaranteed to enable a successful response to the next pandemic going forward. And we don't know what it could be. You know, it doesn't have to be influenza. It could be something completely different. This is what Andy Pollard's also always been emphasizing, right? So that we got lucky with SARS-CoV-2 because coronaviruses had been the subject of intensive research going forward. So I think that is the narrative that urgently needs to be preserved. And that's what we really hope to do with these interviews.
So coming back to your own career, when did your post in Dublin officially start?
January 1st, 2020. So,
oh, I see.
So I flew in, I think, two times. I reopened the door in late 2021. So it was almost like re-entering a time capsule in that office with some drawings from my daughter when she was very small. Still there. So it was also a very interesting time arriving in Dublin, also amidst all of the Brexit furore that was happening during that time. Also personally, quite an intense time.
And I think, yes, given the time, I'll start on this bit now. I'll do the rest of this first. So what is your main area of research interest at the moment? What are you working on now?
So it's a multitude of projects. I've come to characterize myself as a historian of bugs and drugs. So I started off doing antimicrobials. I started off really focusing on drug regulation that turned into a focus on drug innovation, turned into a focus on infectious disease control and surveillance. And my post in Dublin at the moment the post was created by a Wellcome Trust University Award, which centered on the rise of one of the first gold standards for infectious disease surveillance globally, which is the use of bacteriophage or bacteriophage typing. So where you use a set of bacteria infecting viruses to reliably characterize certain bacteria below the species level. And that formed the basis for the global surveillance networks that we still see in action nowadays. And the idea is, once again, to do a long-term history of this, to really understand A, how did this technology rise? What were the Cold War politics of it? But B, really, how is it continuing to shape our knowledge of microbial diversity and infectious disease threats nowadays, including the incredible inequity in surveillance capabilities that often see biosecurity of the global north prioritized in terms of funding, in terms of surveillance foci, above any attempt to control endemic diseases in the global south?
Which presumably is to a certain extent self-defeating, because bugs don't recognize boundaries.
That is the historian's argument, exactly.
Yes. And going back to coronavirus itself, how threatened did you feel personally? You had this infection in February, which could well have been COVID, but subsequently, did you feel that you were yourself at risk?
I obviously didn't know what I had. Who knew what that was? We were expecting a second child during that time, so we were very cautious during all of 2020, including having to go to hospitals for these appointments. Me as the father waiting outside in the car for all of these things. So I think that that very much shaped our personal view of risks, etc. I think personally for me, it's really only been this year really that the guard has started to come down to a greater extent. And I think that's looking at people around the street around me and looking at people on international flights, that seems to have been the experience for the majority of the public too.
And what were your work circumstances like at home with one and then two small children? And, well, and how did you cope with that?
We coped. I think we developed the motto of falling forward. Nothing was perfect. We just had to manage and get on. There was very little else you could do. So it was obviously not ideal in quite small Oxford accommodation with two very young children. But it was also a very intense and very rewarding time in terms of just being able to spend it with your family. I think that's what you appreciate after the effect. If you'd asked me in 2020, I think frustration at lack of infrastructural support, et cetera, might have been at the fore of my mind. But I think in retrospect, I think the pandemic for many people has highlighted the value of the broader context of life surrounding them.
And to what extent did the work that you did on the COVID vaccine, if looking on that as part of your professional development, I know it sounds a terrible thing to say, but do you value that period as something that broadened your understanding of the field that you're interested in?
I think definitely. I think it was a period of very, very intense thinking about how different aspects of my work relate to each other. Before going into the pandemic, I just looked this up on my CV, and actually I wrote a tiny blog, I think that only two people have ever read, for Chomi in Ireland in July 2020. And it was that actually, all of these things I've been working on interrelate. My work on antimicrobials, AMR, infection control, relates to the work of vaccines and how infectious disease research has been neglected for such a long time in high-income areas. It also relates to the to the extreme inequalities about of access to global health infrastructures, but also the extreme selective focus of the global health networks we've put in place for preparedness. And it relates to my policy work, which had become a bit more pronounced running up to the pandemic. But I think after going through the pandemic, there was also the realization that, I don't think, historians have a privileged perspective on it, but that the voice needed to be heard, because everybody started recounting histories and mobilizing history to justify specific forms of intervention or specific exceptionalisms, and that there was a need for history to be present and active in this space.
And that's only going to go on with the inquiry that's underway and that kind of thing. So has your policy work led directly to, have you been called upon to advise public policy areas, or is it so far a matter of writing pieces in the BMJ or the Lancet or whatever and making sure the voice is out there?
So it has been called upon the work itself has been cited in some of the policy reports that have come out, which is great. I do principally see myself as an academic and as a historian. I'm not a policymaker, but it's been very rewarding to see articles, for example, on the structure and limits of change within UK surveillance capabilities cited in the infectious blood products report. With regards to antimicrobial innovation, I think also there's been development in that area. So it's nice to see people approach me. How far my opinions actually end up shaping anything that comes out in the actual final policy room, I don't know. But I think academically, in terms of media visibility, but also in terms of policy visibility, clearly something's changed since 2020.
And you obviously have a unique perspective as a historian, in that you don't have an axe to grind in the way that because I mean, quite often people who are involved in biomedical research make policy comments, but they, you could see that they had interest in pursuing a particular line. But as you've mentioned earlier, the historian has the wider and longer perspective.
I mean, we also all have interest, right? I've been associated in a certain political milieu. I hold certain values. I think what I can be is I can be explicit about some of this. But in other areas, I can also explicitly say that I'm agnostic about outcomes, but I want to be transparent about path dependencies going into it.
I think we're pretty much. Oh, yes. Well, I'll ask you this question. How do you think future historians will frame the global response to the COVID pandemic?
I think that's the wonderful thing about history. You never really know, right? So, you know, what kind of broader trend you're witnessing without completely understanding all of the huge forces and all of the contingencies that are interacting in one specific moment. I think what we'll see for sure over the next decade or so is that COVID has reshaped the world of global health. I think it hasn't broken the biosecurity mode of dealing with global health, despite all of the hopes for increased access, despite all of the rhetoric in 2020 and all of these things. What we see when we see about the numbers of people who got access, the defense of intellectual property, and I think to a great extent, control over capabilities, over access of capabilities, we see that COVID has accelerated pre-existing tendencies within global health, which weren't necessarily good for wider groups of people. But I think also what we've seen is just the rise of new actors in the space. I mean, in the West, we think about the AstraZeneca vaccine, we think about the mRNA vaccines, et cetera. But if we think about which vaccines first reach large parts of the global population, we see very different actors coming out. I mean, Russia and Ukraine, obviously nowadays, that's also again shifted the geopolitical equation there. But the role of China, the role of India is something that I think future historians will shape and focus on to a much greater extent. We see it in antimicrobials, right? China manufactures 80% of active pharmaceutical ingredients for all of the global antimicrobials nowadays. And that is only going to increase also in the field of vaccination. So we may be too myopic to see it in the current commentaries we see in the West. But I think what COVID has shown is the limits of what systems we put in place in the 1990s with the hope of trickle down and, you know, lots of rhetoric, but actually little capacity building can achieve when it comes to the big global health challenges.
And what about preparedness? I mean, I think there was a hope that both globally and nationally, a lesson would be learned about the need to be prepared. But I've certainly heard in the past year or so quite cynical views about how there's a sense that the caravan has moved on and we're not putting enough thought into the next pandemic, which everybody agrees will be here in 5 to 10 years.
It's very difficult to answer that. I think it's obviously right not to just focus on pandemics, but also on the climate emergency, which is the accelerator of the pandemics, is a huge accelerator of global injustice, but is obviously also a result of the injustice itself. So I think it is right to also leave the emergency and completely biosecurity mode of policymaking that we've inhabited for a very long time. However, the infrastructures we've put in place so far, I mean, will the new WHO pandemic hub, would it actually be able to prevent SARS-CoV-2 from spreading if we had exactly the same outbreak nowadays? I doubt it. I mean, perhaps we could have had early information, but that the politics we saw play out and we still see playing out with the lab leak theory and, you know, all of these politically very loaded debates about origins, I think they're very ill-suited to actually stopping diseases from, not from emerging only, but also from spreading once they've emerged. And I think we need to, if I had a hope for the future, it would be that we perhaps move away from the only stamp out and control, you know, the boots on the ground, parachuting people in to stamp out a disease outbreak mode of the pandemic narrative, but really focus on what was actually the big cause of death during SARS-CoV-2. And that was reduced access to healthcare, not enough access to social care, not quick enough rollout of the vaccines to where they were needed. So the second, the much more important stage of the pandemic, you know, once the floodgates have broken, once we've been seeded with infection, that is the crucial story. And I, to be honest, and this is a dark view, I don't think we've done anything to improve that stage. I mean, where are the extra beds, isolation facilities? Where are the social care networks? I don't see them at the moment. And I think that is a crucial mistake.
Mm. And I think this is the final one. Has your experience of working through the pandemic changed your attitude or your approach to your own work? And are there things that you'd like to see change in the future, apart from what you've just mentioned?
I think the entire discipline of history has been, to a certain extent, changed by this experience of collective crisis. Historians are always fascinated about generational experiences and how they shape perspectives going forward. And this was a global event that every single person on the globe witnessed, experienced in different ways, but it was the same, you know, event, right? So I think historians will for a long time study this event, but we've also all been changed by how we go forward with it. What I already see now in lots of the histories in other fields, which previously perhaps didn't pay too much attention to disease, crisis, ecological collapse, is that I think there has been a very big sensitization in many other parts of the field for all of these various things that are encapsulated in a pandemic, also the emotional experience of crisis. Once again, we are, you know, historians are never neutral, right? We're inherently embedded. And I think this reflectiveness about what this experience meant for us in terms of what we can see in sources going back, that's a very big thing.
Okay, thank you very much.